So I'm grateful that Janine found that story, and you will see why in a moment. It has been a joy to work with you in preparing for today. The welfare of each is bound up with the welfare of all. What a wonderful and practical illustration of the interdependent web of life. Pollen swirling from farm to farm. And I have to tell you that the pollen swirling has affected my allergies, so if I sneeze, that's why. And what a wise farmer, recognizing the interdependence and using it to his own and his neighbor's advantage. Now, we know intellectually that our lives are bound up together, that what affects one of us affects all of us. But we don't always behave as if we know that, do we? We live in a culture that celebrates independence, and not just on the 4th of July. We are encouraged to be independent. And that's natural. As children, we depend on our parents for everything. But even then, we have a strong urge to do things on our own, whether it's tying our shoes or crossing the street without holding our parents' hand. But when we have a nightmare, or we get lost in a department store, we run back to the security of our parents' arms. As adolescents, and as a former middle school teacher, I know this well, it is our job to sever those ties. Becoming our own selves, pushing against and sometimes past our parents. Sometimes even when it goes against our best interest. I think of a child asking their parent, "What should I wear today?" and then choosing the opposite outfit. As we get older, though, most people form new relationships with our friends, our chosen families, and some go on to start their own families, which leads us to value and act on our interdependence. We may also renegotiate those relationships with a family of origin, recognizing that we can be independent and interdependent with our parents and our siblings. I've done it. I've gone through all of those stages. Fortunately, my parents survived teen years, so did I. But I was a single person for a very long time. And I got to be very independent. I was so used to the way my life was. I used to joke that if I ever were to marry, I would have to either have a huge house or we'd have to live in separate houses because I couldn't give up my independence, my little rituals. And then I met Jamie. And he moved into my tiny little bungalow, and we lived there together happily, and we even added a cat to our family. So much for our independent, for my independent lifestyle. But now I can't imagine my life without them. Which is all to say, I think we go through stages of dependence, independence, interdependence throughout our lives. I still like to be independent from time to time. And I'm guessing the farmer in Janine's story went through those stages too. First, depending on someone else to give him the seed. Then, finding the seed that was so much better than everyone else's and keeping it all to himself so they could grow that wonderful corn and win those prizes. But then realizing that his own crops were affected by his neighbor's crops, so that it was in his best interest to share his seed with them. Dependent, independent, interdependent. And yet, he must be keeping some secrets because he's the one who is winning those prizes year after year. So that we can be dependent, independent, and interdependent all at the same time. I think that's what Thomas Merton was saying in the passage we adapted for the lighting of the chalice today. None of us can be completely independent, completely self-sufficient. We do depend on others. The pollen will spread to all the farms, whether the farmer acknowledges it or not. Recognizing that interdependence helps him to act differently in ways that enhance his own life and the lives of others. So the question is, how good are we at recognizing interdependence? Or does our need for independence sometimes blind us? I'm guessing that whether we realize it or not, we have a deep-seated, very strong sense of independence that gets in the way. I was thinking of a man who was contemplating the death of his wife and wondering how he was going to get along by himself. And being afraid of depending too much on his friends for companionship. Even said, "I don't want to be a burden." But then someone asked him, "What would you want to do if it were one of your friends who lost his wife? Wouldn't you want to help them?" I imagine many of us have similar experiences where we've wanted to help out a friend in situations where we would have been reluctant to ask for help ourselves. Can you think of a time when you've been reluctant to ask or even to accept support when it's offered? Was your need for independence keeping someone else from fulfilling their desire to show care and affection? Can you think of a time like that? What if the farmer's neighbors had rejected his offer of that excellent seed? Their inferior plants would have degraded his crop. He would have suffered. In Merton's words, we are all inclined to love, to do good, to dedicate ourselves to others. Who are we to deny others opportunities to fulfill that inclination? Now, of course, it's possible to become overly dependent on others, to wear out our welcome, and to take when we could be giving. As with much of life, it's a matter of balance and mutuality. From you I receive, to you I give. Together we share, and from this we live. We all need to receive. We all need to give. Now, some of you may be thinking that I'm preaching to the choir here. Of course, we believe in interdependence. Otherwise, why would we be in church? We can all be spiritual on our own, but we can't be religious without community. And yet, Unitarian Universalists can be fiercely independent for good and for ill. And we come by that independence honestly. Some of you may know the term congregational polity. That's the way we govern ourselves. Each Unitarian Universalist congregation chooses their own minister, their own mission and vision, their own covenant, their own bylaws. We inherited this polity from the Puritans who first landed in North America, who rejected the hierarchical structure of the Church of England, in which faraway bishops told churches what to do. Can you imagine anyone outside of here telling us what to do? But congregational polity is not just about the self-government of the individual congregations. In its original conception, in the Cambridge Platform, it also requires that those churches belong to a community of autonomous congregations. Now, you can imagine up in Massachusetts, that's easy to do, right, with Unitarian churches in every little town. There was an expectation that congregations would be in relationship, offering care, consultation, admonition, participation, recommendation, and relief to one another. In 1997, the UUA Commission on Appraisal wrote a report recommending that we revive our awareness of that original intent, that we're not separate little islands, but that we are a collection, an association of congregations working together. But I'm sad to say that in places like Virginia, where our churches are geographically distant, we often don't have much to do with each other. It's sad. Now, I've been a strong advocate of our congregation becoming more active within our cluster, our region, and our association, even before I went off to seminary. For a long time, my only understanding of Unitarian Universalism was what I learned in this church. But as soon as I started attending workshops and assemblies with folks from other congregations, my perspective broadened and my commitment deepened. Ask any of the TJMC folks who have participated in gatherings like General Assembly. Kate just got back. Or SUSE, the Southeast UU Summer Institute. Raise your hand if you've been to SUSE. I get to go for the first time this year. It's like summer camp for UU families. You'll get a sense of the possibilities for interdependence within our movement. Oh, Sarah also went to GA. Sorry, I didn't see you. Think about how it feels to sing your favorite hymn. And then imagine what that would feel like with thousands of people singing it with you and loving it just as much as you do. It's pretty astounding. But there are opportunities closer to home. We belong to the Blue Ridge cluster of congregations that stretches from Waynesboro down to Lynchburg and Blacksburg. And this spring, they sponsored an anti-racism conference over in Waynesboro, and it was so exciting to see how many people came from different congregations. And there are opportunities much farther from home, too. We have two partner churches, one in the Kashi Hills of India and the other in Transylvania. And several members of our church have traveled. Glenn, have you been to India or Transylvania?
India.
And was warmly welcomed, yes? A few years ago, a Unitarian minister from the Kashi Hills was here for a dinner. And I got to know him better on the drive down to Charlotte, North Carolina. Hearing about his ministry, here's a man who has a day job. He works in television. And then on weekends, he drives long distances on very bad roads to preach in different churches. And also, fielding his questions about race relations in the United States gave me an appreciation for what we have here, but it also helped me to see some of our shortcomings in a very new light. More recently, Reverend István Torak, his wife and his daughter, Carola, visited us here from Transylvania for almost a month. And getting to know our Transylvanian siblings gave us a new perspective on our Unitarian heritage. And in May, when I graduated from Meadville-Lombard Theological School, István sent me a message on Facebook congratulating me, and he sent me a psalm. And he also said that I was welcome in his pulpit anytime I came to Transylvania. And Jamie found this morning that his daughter is coming to Pennsylvania for 9 months. So that tie is still there, even across the miles. We are an independent church with congregational polity, but we have opportunities to share what we know and to learn from others, both near and far. Like the wise farmer, we can choose to share our good seeds and accept those of others. We can choose to recognize our interdependence and to celebrate it. And here we are on the eve of Independence Day, preparing to celebrate the birth of our nation, which seems to me like a good time to consider how we as a nation recognize and act on our interdependence with the rest of the world. As Janine alluded to in her opening words, this is a time in our national life when there seems to be a swing back into isolationism. This past year, and as we move forward, we've been hearing all kinds of things about building a wall on our southern border and expelling immigrants, about closing the door to refugees, about putting America first. But we can't blame all that on just election year rhetoric, not if we're honest with ourselves. This country has been grappling with its responsibilities to our fellow inhabitants on this planet for a very long time, much more than a year. And not just the human inhabitants. Our country has been very slow to sign on to international agreements about climate change, despite the fact that we're responsible for quite a bit of that greenhouse gas. But as Reverend Wickstrom reminded us last week, our country is a relatively young one. We are in our adolescence, which means we are still exercising our independence, even all these years after we first declared it. Which means we still have time to mature and grow into our interdependence, to recognize how our welfare is bound up with the welfare of the rest of the world. Because whether we recognize it or not, it is. And then, who knows, maybe we'll slip back again. With Brexit, we've seen a much older country than ours reject interdependence and reestablish their independence. But it's a dance, isn't it? It doesn't stop. Dependence, independence, interdependence. We know that our welfare is bound up with the rest of the world's, and we feel it. Whenever tragedy strikes in Istanbul or Bangladesh or Baghdad, we feel the sorrow, the anguish, the fear, and the loss. But we need to do more than feel or think about our interdependence. We need to act. In the prophetic words of Elie Wiesel, whose death we mourn and whose life we celebrate today, he writes, "We must take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. Sometimes we must interfere. When human lives are endangered, when human dignity is in jeopardy, national borders and sensitivities become irrelevant. Wherever men and women are persecuted because of their race, religion, or political views, that place must, at that moment, become the center of the universe. National borders and sensitivities become irrelevant. We are interdependent." Now, so far, I've been talking about our interdependence in fairly utilitarian terms. It is good and useful for us to be able to recognize that we are interdependent, that the pollen from our neighbor's fields will affect our yield, that none of us are completely independent or self-sufficient, and so we should accept the help of others and offer help when we can. That even though our congregation is independent in terms of our self-governance, we can benefit from the perspective and experiences of other Unitarian Universalists. And that we must resist the voices of isolationism in our nation and recognize our responsibilities to the rest of the world. Like the wise farmer, we benefit from recognizing our interdependence and acting with that knowledge in mind. But celebrating our interdependence is not just a useful thing. It is a spiritual thing. It can grow our souls. Now, I'm guessing that some of you may be uncomfortable with that kind of language, but I encourage you to stick with me just for a few minutes. I took a class on global religions last summer, and we spent a fair amount of time discussing inter-religious dialogue and how we might be better at talking to people whose beliefs differ from our own. We can practice that right here, can't we? One of my favorite resources in that course was a document called the Dialogue Decalogue, which is a 10 commandments for ensuring that we enter into conversations with those of different beliefs with open hearts and open minds. The first commandment begins, "The primary purpose of dialogue is to learn." That is, to change and grow in the perception and understanding of reality, and then to act accordingly. Likewise, when we recognize our interdependence and act with that knowledge in mind, we are entering into a kind of dialogue, a relationship with some other that has the potential to help us change and grow in our perception and understanding of reality. I like it the way Albert Einstein explained it. This has been attributed to him. Part of it may be someone's editing, but it's still good words. He wrote, "A human being is part of a whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He or she experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circles of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty." Celebrating our interdependence is a way of helping us to escape the prison of our optical delusion, a delusion that says that we are separate from the rest of creation. But instead, we are a part of the whole, of the holy, of what some call God.